treatise on the future of technology is often thick and inaccessible. Today's guests, however, turn their expertise into a page-turning, pulse-quickening techno-thriller. They're P.W. Singer and August Cole this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Joining me, as he does every week, is my great friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. We're joined each week by great storytellers, authors, novelists, filmmakers, and more to make sense of the big stories shaping public life in the United States today. This week, we're joined by two old friends, P.W. Singer and August Cole, are co-authors of a new techno-thriller set in the not-too-distant future, Burn In. Peter, August, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be on the show.
So, August, give us a little rundown. What is Burn In about?
Burn In is a novel of the real robotic revolution. Much of the narrative and stories that we tell about our relationships with robotics and artificial intelligence in the future often have to do with a robot uprising. And this isn't anything like that at all. What we're really exploring is how the transformative technologies that are everywhere today, AI, software, robotic systems, are going to result in far-reaching and sweeping changes in American society. And what I think is really critical that people need to understand is that we're not ready for that. Politically, we're not ready economically, and even technologically. So Burn In follows an FBI counterterrorism agent in pursuit of a bad guy who's trying to use all these technologies to turn America against itself. And she's partnered against her will with a robot for the first time, and a breakthrough for the sorts of law enforcement that today would be done with two people. So we're in this point where we have an unusual blend of fact and fiction in a techno thriller, because we want people to understand that though this takes place over a decade in the future, all of these trends and technologies are in fact real.
Well, and so, Peter, you know, you've spent a lot of your career looking at sort of the future evolution of technology, both military and civilian. What is the big technology that's going to most disrupt American public life that you capture in the book, and that as you look at the next 10, 15 years?
Sure. So in many ways, that subtitle tells it all. The idea of a real robotic revolution hits at it. The word robot itself is exactly 100 years old. It was created in a science fiction play. Well, now robotics and artificial intelligence, they're becoming real, but they're becoming real in a very different way than sci-fi told us. So it's not a robot uprising. It's the idea of what it means to live through a new kind of industrial revolution. If you think about the last industrial revolution, you know, it changed everything from politics to business to even your family life. And we're seeing the same thing play out right now with artificial intelligence. It's happening in ways that are visible to us, you know, the idea of a driverless car, but it's also happening in the background, the way that AI has disrupted fields that range from medicine to finance to the apps that your kids play with. But because of that, it's yielding a whole new series of winners and losers in society, in business, even on a national level. And so what Burn In is about is exploring that, taking people on a tour of that world to come, but different than regular sci-fi. It uses the tool of story to share the latest research. So baked into the story are actually 300 explanations and predictions with 27 pages of research endnotes like you would have in a nonfiction book. So it really does capture what's that most important technology overall, AI, but how it's going to express itself everywhere from Starbucks to your home to what it's like for a police officer in the future.
So August,
Talk to us, peer, let's say 10 years into the future, and tell us what, in terms of daily life, the changes will be for people, in terms of not just people in the United States, but global citizens.
I think there are some really interesting previews all around us right now of what life will be like in the next 10 years. The fact that we are currently in the midst of a massive reorganizing of how Americans work due to the pandemic response, the virtualization and remote working paradigm has been rushed forward in fields that range from education to medicine to a sector of the economy like retail, which was already being transformed by internet-based businesses.
Not to
And at the
mention
same,
television production, too.
the fact that we're able to do this together in a virtual context relies on many of the underlying technologies in software that are going to have even farther-reaching effects in the coming decade. So waking up in 2030, what you're going to find is that much of the really disruptive and innovative technologies, as they often are, will be fairly seamless and invisible. But you'll have these really interesting moments where your preferences will be shaped by algorithms that may determine what news you hear in the morning when you ask your voice assistant to tell you what's going on. You might find that the driverless car that picks you up to work takes a route that is based off of an algorithm that responds not only to your desire to get to work in a certain time, but even perhaps your mood, because it sent uses data from your biosensors that knows that, you know what, you need to take a quick drive by the water to lower your blood pressure. Those sorts of, positive and nudges, I think, are a nice way to think about a future that is a fairly enjoyable one to live in. The flip side of that is a bit darker and something we explore in the book.
So that sort of technology will obviously be available to many people, certainly people of means who have the economic wherewithal or income to have those technologies. But there will be a lot of people then as now who will not have access to this technology. So it sounds like there's going to be another division of haves versus have-nots, to use sort of the hackneyed term. And certainly, if you look globally, I would say that that definitely would be the case and will vary greatly by country and even here in the US by region and community. Talk about that.
This I, or Pete, you want to go ahead?
Yeah, I'll jump on that one. The science fiction writer William Gibson described how the future is already here. It's just unevenly distributed. And you can think about that in a couple of ways. One is that much of the technology that we see in this future, or even that experience of those subtle nudges and influences, you already can see examples of that out there. But you can also think about that uneven distribution and just what you raised, the fact that you will have haves and have-nots, whether it's in terms of the access to the technology. And it's interesting to think about what is advanced today and the way people use it today might be dated tomorrow. So, for example, there's a scene in the book where our main character is in a crowded train station, and they very quickly can tell who's wealthy or not based off of who's staring blankly into the distance, because that means they're using the new technology of augmented reality, which is something that, for example, the Apple company, it's their second biggest investment level, whereas the people that aren't as wealthy are still looking down at their screens, like, of course, what most kids do today. So you see that kind of uneven distribution, but you also can think about it in terms of economic winners and losers. So yes, you will have a world with more AI, more robotics. You'll also still have homelessness and the like. And in fact, we may even see some of that driven by this new technology. It's funny to talk about this for what is a novel, but again, it crosses with nonfiction, is that we built a database of job automation reports, reports from everything from Oxford University to the World Bank to consulting companies like McKinsey and PricewaterhouseCoopers. What do they think this technology is going to do to the future of jobs? And they found that as you rewire the economy, there's massive disruption that awaits. There will be some new kinds of jobs created, but there'll also be people left behind. Oxford University, for example, found that when they looked at 702 different jobs, everything from, truck drivers to doctors to lawyers, 702 different professions out there, they found that 47% of them will see disruption or complete replacement over the next 20 years. And that's going to be challenging for America, but also what you can do with a novel is play that out in the experience of inside a home, inside a family. What does that feel like?
So I'm curious, August, maybe you can speak to this. Societally, are we ready for this level of change? And if we're not, what do we need to do to be ready?
Given the potential disruption that almost certainly lies ahead, I would say we're not ready. And the events of the last few months have, I think, revealed how ill-prepared we are at a national and even local level to handle, for example, large amounts of people who are unable to work as much as they want for forces that are well outside of their control. The response then on the part of government is a really interesting problem to try to unpack because every time you come up with a remedy, you get ensnared in the old politics of what work means in American society and the value that it has in the narrative of what as individuals we contribute and what kind of gives us meaning as well. I mean, how many times do you go to a barbecue and the first thing somebody says is, "So what do you do?" Well, what if you live in an era where work is not actually going to be able to define you because it is not going to be the primary economic activity? What if you get more money off the data you produce? What if you are receiving more money from your local government or the federal government? In terms of retraining and the initiatives that you see out there today, there are certainly some very, I think, reasonable and sensible approaches to try to allow people to transition out of industries into those that will be growing. But if the net effect is less jobs overall, that is not going to be the solution. In fact, it's going to have to be a larger conversation about what do we value with individuals and how they contribute to society, because it won't look like work as we know it today.
Just a quick follow-up on that. Does that fundamentally change the social contract between citizens and the government as a result?
The rise of AI and robotics is going to have a fundamental impact on the social contract, absolutely. And this is something that is going to, I think, have an enduring impact on the way that we see America in the 21st century, not just in a national sense, but globally, as Wayne said, how China handles this transition, how Europe handles this transition, South America, the subcontinent in Asia, India. That to me is going to be a really interesting reframing of what it means to be a great power in the 21st century. It's often still talked about in kind of a hard power contest of who has more ships or tanks or even economic influence. But in fact, I think the resiliency or the ability to adapt to this era may be more determinant in terms of who at the end of the 21st century still exists as a nation.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard 4 times every weekend on SiriusXM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a great crew at Rhode Island PBS. We're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me, as he does every week in the co-host chair, is my friend G. Wayne Miller. He's an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal and the author of 17 books. You can find Wayne on Twitter too at G. Wayne Miller. And our guests this week are P.W. Singer and August Cole, two talented writers, national security analysts, and co-authors of Burn In, a novel of the real robotic revolution. Find both of them on Twitter. PW Singer is at Peter W. Singer, and August Cole is at August underscore Cole, Cole.
So I have a two-part question, and Peter, maybe you can take the first crack at it. First question is, why write fiction and not a white paper or nonfiction? And the second part is, how did you two write this thing together? I've collaborated on writing with other people, and I would just say that it can be difficult at times. It can also be rewarding. So Peter, take a crack at that.
The answer to your first question is no one ever said to someone else, Man, this was such an enjoyable PowerPoint. You ought to read it on your next vacation. No one ever said, and I'm an academic and I've written these, no one ever said, man, this white paper, it just kept me up late at night in bed reading. I just wanted to, turn the next page. But with novels, they do that. And we actually experienced that in the past with a book that August and I did together called Ghost Fleet, where I've written a series of nonfiction books and they've had impact and done well, but it was this novel that actually had greater impact than all of the others. It led to investigations by everyone from the Pentagon to the GAO. August and I were invited to brief the real world lessons of this project, everywhere from the White House Situation Room to we testified to Congress to the Nobel Institute. The Navy even named a $3.6 billion program after that novel. And so with Burn In, we wanted to lean into that, to hit that important change that Jim was asking about that we see swirling around us. But one of the most important aspects of this change is that we know it's important, and yet we don't well understand it. And I can give you numbers behind that. 91% of leaders say that AI is the most important technology out there. It's being woven into the strategy for everything from the US military to China to Fortune 500 companies that range from Google to McDonald's and John Deere. So over 90% say this is the most important thing out there. And yet only 17% say, I have a passing familiarity with it, let alone all the applications and dilemmas that we have to figure out. So that's a massive disconnect. And we realize that, to close that disconnect, most people are not going to go take a course in it. Most people are not going to read a white paper on it, but maybe they'll read an enjoyable novel that, follows the hunt for a terrorist through the streets of Washington, D.C., and yet they'll walk away from it having learned because it's a way of sharing this research. That also points to how we work together. We're basically serving twin masters. We're carrying out the research simultaneously to the world building, and we're exchanging back and forth. So this is not a case of, you write one chapter and I'll write the other. We're constantly sharing things back and forth, and it might be a research study that we find, or it might be a little personal experience that we uncovered. For example, what the rug inside the White House really is. Well, that's actually from a personal experience, and then you can carry that across into giving a scene inside the book that added dose of realism.
So, August, you talk about the partnership here in terms of the actual writing. I mean, do you send drafts back and forth? We're talking now about burn-in. How does that work? Do you do Zoom calls? Do you get on the phone? How does it work? We're always interested in learning about craft here on Storing the Public Square.
The caveat I give is that every writer and every partnership is, of course, different. But I think the patterns of work that we have would be familiar to those that work, say, writing films. We collaborate on concept. We spend a great deal amount of time on the story's fundamentals, and that could include, blocking out almost scene by scene the entire book, and then having done research prior to that, outlining, continuing to do research throughout. That may be determinant in terms of how the story evolves, because technology can be incredibly influential. And then when it comes to the actual writing, I think we have a lot of trust, which is a theme that's woven throughout the book in terms of how humans trust technology. But as two collaborators, I believe we have a lot of trust in each other's judgment and also skill, so that when your co-writer says, I think we can write this better, or just simply overwrite something, that you have that belief in the end that the story and the project are going to be stronger for it. And we talk, especially when we worked on Ghost Fleet, trying to figure this pattern of work out, which we more or less have continued with Burn In. We had a lot of really good conversations about how we like to work in our means and methods. And so, there aren't right now, for example, shared drive documents that are capable really of eating a whole manuscript. We use Microsoft Word, which is really tricky because sometimes you send a version out into the wild and you want to make sure that you're working on the right one when it comes back. That's not something that that we're immune to being concerned about as well. But traditionally, we're writing in Microsoft Word, emailing back and forth, and then we use shared drive documents for research notes. And there are times we'll break up sections of the book and might use that, I guess, a little bit. But by and large, we're engaging in kind of a regular electronic communications. We live in different cities, so we don't have in-person meetings very often. And in fact, that seems to work okay. Even when we do have quite intense bouts of editing, I think we had 7, 8 days in the fall during one of the final write-throughs where we went line by line through the book, constantly asking ourselves, can we make this better? Can we make this better? And we emerged out of that, both of us, said, hey, that was pretty fun. Which I think is a, which I think is a great test. It's sort of like, would you hire someone you'd want to go on a 3-week camping trip or not? And that's to me, could you edit day in and day out for a week with them? Well, I think Pete and I have continued to pass that test.
So Peter, August mentioned the importance of trust, and also the fact that trust is a theme throughout the book. I have this recollection about a MIT Technology Review cover from 2014 that boasted that big data would save democracy. And then, 2016 happens, and it looks like big data and the tech firms are sort of, being used by the highest bidders to undermine democracy. And so when we think about some of those things that are sacred to a republic, sacred to our country, I guess my question is, can we trust technology?
It's a great question, and it's one of the themes that runs through the book. And when you think about it, every story actually has these underlying themes. Moby Dick is not actually about a hunt for a whale. And for us, yes, it's about a hunt for a terrorist, but there are underlying themes, and one of which is, as you hit, is this notion of trust. And actually, the double meaning of trust. There is one meaning, which is sort of the I trust you, I find you trustworthy. But engineers have a different definition of trust. It's the idea that the system, the technology, works in the predicted manner. So, for example, I can trust that someone is a liar and operate effectively in the world based on that, the knowledge that they will always lie, right? They're not trustworthy, but by this different definition, I can be effective. And what we're seeing in America is both these meanings of trust are under siege right now. Our sense of trustworthiness of institutions, but also things not working the way that we planned. And that some of it is happening naturally, some of it is happening because of market forces, and some of it is happening because people deliberately plinking away, undermining that. And what it does is leaves our institutions, whether it's democracy, but also our infrastructure, our healthcare infrastructure, or the power that runs your home, incredibly brittle, less resilient. And so what we do in Burn-In is play that forward, explore that world, but also come at I think a really interesting thing that you hit on in terms of those companies and why we feel that tech lash is that there's a very fine line right now between utopian visions of the world and dystopian. One person's utopia often feels a little dystopian to someone else, and I think we can very much feel that coming out of a lot of the effect that the tech companies have had on our world right now. And so that's what we try and play with in the book. And you, and through fiction, through story, you get to see it from multiple different character perspectives.
So I want to return briefly to the issue of haves and have-nots on a global level. Those nations that are impoverished, that are not going to be able to embrace this technology, certainly not to the degree that developed countries can, is there a global response that should be given through the United Nations, through other nations helping? Because I mean, you walk this through and you clearly can see that nations that already are hurting significantly in terms of the quality of life, in terms of malnutrition and disease, and we can go through a very long list, they're going to be even more at a disadvantage. What is the global response, or what should it be, and where would it come from?
I think one of the things we've already seen is the acknowledgement from international organizations that internet connectivity is, effectively a human right. What comes next, though, is a really interesting question because the who implements, aspect to that is very, very complex. What you're going to see is different visions of these highly connected AI-driven and robotics-driven societies playing out, with countries like China particularly exporting a model that can ensure things like social control. It can offer these sorts of systems that serve both commercial and government purposes in a hybrid way at heavily subsidized rates, that for countries like you say that are grappling with, let's say, the effects of climate change and seeing unrest and are unwilling or unable to respond, the authoritarian impulse being offered by some of the technological systems that will come out of what Beijing will be offering, for example, is going to be really hard to resist. At the same time, could you imagine a U.S. Agency for International Technological Development emerge? I have a hard time seeing that in the current situation that we're in right now, but it's not out of the realm of possibility that in the future you might actually see sort of a techno development mandate. Because the U.S., if you look back at the last 60 to 70 years, offered a framework of sorts for the world to engage commercially, and that was not in the same networked way that is possible now from other people or nations. It doesn't even have to be nations, to be clear, who can kind of create similar economic structures and networks. A non-state actor that could offer to wire the world up commercially along economic even lines that allow social and automation could compete in that. Similar organizations, wealthy philanthropists, can play on that global stage in a way they couldn't before because of the scalability, because of the speed with which AI and robotics allow things to get done.
We've got about 45 seconds left here. Peter, in one of our conversations before taping, you mentioned to me something, I think you called it the rules of the real, and your responsibility as the author in creating those rules. For our audience, could you just in about literally about 35 seconds unpack what you mean by the rules of the real?
So it's not pure sci-fi, it's combining research in. So that means real world places, not on a distant planet. It means a real world timeline, not hundreds of years in the future, but less than one generation ahead. It means real technology, no vaporware, already has to exist somewhere. And then finally, real people acting in, both good guys and bad guys, acting in a realistic way. And hopefully that both grounds it, but also makes it more exciting and more enjoyable.
Well, I'd say that Burn-In is grounded and it is exciting. It is enjoyable. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have this week. Peter Singer, August Cole, the book is Burn-In. Thank you so much for being with us. That's all the time we have. But if you want to know more about storing the public square, you can visit pellcenter.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Storing the Public Square.